Yes, I think we can start. We have got a long day. We had a long program from Tuesday, yesterday, and today. Welcome, honorable members. Welcome to the governor, deputy governors, and officials of the Reserve Bank, Prudential Authority. Welcome to the staff of officials of Parliament, Treasury, if they are here. Today's meeting is about briefing by the Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority on their annual reports for the purposes of the BRRRs. The meeting is officially open. Apologies, Madam Teu.
I didn't receive any, sir. I didn't receive any apologies.
Okay. Is the governor here? Because we are going to item 3 now for briefing.
Yes, Chairperson, I'm here.
Yeah, you are welcome, Governor, and your team. Let's right away move to item 3, briefing by the South African Reserve Bank Governor on the APP, on the annual reports. Over to you, Governor Khanya.
So thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Committee. I must remember, do I have to share this presentation? I know we have forwarded it, or is the other host taking charge?
Sister Tebo, are you able to project the presentation, or he can do it on his side?
He said he wanted to do it on his side. So you can check
from your side. Okay, Governor, you can do it from your side.
Okay.
Okay.
Can you see that?
Yeah, you can see the screen now. I mean the slide.
Thank you. One more thing here. Okay, while I work out the controls here, let me also say that I am joined by the deputy governors, deputy governor Naidu, deputy governor Kasim, deputy governor Chasivana, they will be sharing the load. I'm also joined by the other staff members of the Reserve Bank, which in the interest of time, I will introduce them as they have to speak. We have got the Chief Operating Officer, Morgan Pile. We have got Sheena Reynolds, who is the Secretary of the bank, and we have got the communication team. In terms of the presentation, we would like to just very briefly retouch the role of the South African Reserve Bank, look at the macroeconomic overview and outlook. The one that is in the annual report is already very outdated because the annual report was published in June, and so that report is now the economic situation has changed significantly, so we will take you through that today. And then I will also then do the highlights from the annual report. And then after that, I will hand over to Deputy Governor Naidu, in his capacity as the CEO of the Prudential Authority to do the Prudential Authority report. Say that the bank's mandate in terms of the constitution is to protect the value of the currency in the interest of balanced and sustainable economic growth. The Financial Sector Regulations Act, which came into effect in August 2017, mandates the South African Reserve Bank to maintain, promote, and enhance financial stability in South Africa. The third key functions which are captured in the South African Reserve Bank Act include, amongst others, the issuing of banknotes and coins. We regulate and supervise certain entities in the financial system. We ensure that there is effective functioning of the national payment system. And this national payment system is one of the least understood parts of the functioning of the bank. People do not realize that when you withdraw money from an ATM or you swipe your card to pay for goods and services, what facilitates that is actually the national payment system, which is run by the South African Reserve Bank. We also manage the official gold and foreign exchange reserves of the country, and we administer the country's remaining exchange control regulations, and we are also a banker to the government. The structure of the shareholding of the Reserve Bank, we have a shareholding structure, but the public is the beneficiary. The SARB is one of six central banks that still have private shareholder participation. There are 2 million shares in issue. Dividends are kept at 10 cents a share with a maximum total payout of 200,000 rand a year. 90% of any remaining surplus accrues to the government after setting aside contingencies and tax. Shareholding does provide for shareholders to vote for members of the board, some members of the board, but the shareholding provides members to a board with limited power. Since 1996, several legislative changes were made to clarify the role of the shareholders, limit the rights of foreign shareholders, and reduce how many shares each shareholder, together with their associates, is permitted to hold. The board helps ensure good governance, but does not have a say on policy or regulatory decisions. The government appoints 8 members, including the 4 executives, that is the governor and the 3 deputy governors, and the shareholders appoint the other 7 members of the board. In terms of the macroeconomic outlook, which is where I would like to move to, it's not a pretty picture. The COVID-19 has had a huge global shock, and growth in South Africa's major trading partners was also adversely affected. Just to put the things in context, that in with the global financial crisis, South Africa's major trading partners had a contraction of 0.6%, and for 2020, we are expecting a contraction of South Africa's major trading partners of 4.7% with the recovery coming in 2021. South African growth is also going to be much lower as we had to respond to the health crisis and the response to the health crisis that we have seen around the world has been very similar to that in South Africa, which is where countries went into a lockdown. We expect that this year the economy will actually contract by 8.2% with a recovery that starts in the third quarter of this year into the following year. The recovery is in progress, but it is from a very low starting point. What you see on the panel here are the subsectors and how they have been affected. The tourism sector has been the most adversely affected, and the reason is very important here, because even as the countries were opening up, people are still reluctant to actually travel. So you could see that many sectors are rebounding, but the tourism sector will remain at the bottom there. There are indicators that are already showing that they have recovered to pre-COVID level. We have seen a recovery from the electricity sector, from the food, drinks, and hospitality. Although hospitality, there has been a big knock for the hotel sector. But in total, what we are seeing is that in the third quarter of this year, the economy would be growing again, and we actually expect a growth on a seasonally adjusted annualized basis of around 45%. There are other indications, though, that suggest that there have been longer-term damage to the economy with major job losses. And as we have seen, when the figures were released, the labor force figures were released, it seems to indicate that unemployment had dropped, but that is a statistical calculation rather than a reflection of what has really happened, because what has happened is that the labor force had shrunk because people had stopped looking for work. The economy was under lockdown. It was no point in people looking for work. But the important figure to focus on here is that the number of the employed people actually declined in absolute terms by 2.2 million people. And that is what policy making should actually be focusing on. Moving on, that the GDP would grow faster in 2021 and in 2022 after a terrible 2020. The slide there shows that the contraction of this year of 8.2, we expect that there would be growth of just over 4% for 2021 and 2.6% in 2022. We must explain that big rebound in 2021 is because you have got this big contraction in 2020. So when the economy recovers, it looks like a big bounce, and we normally call that the base effect. So it will be that the economy is recovering from a very low base, and it might just give the impression that you are in a boom. We are not quite in a boom. If anything, we expect that the economy will only return to the 2019 level only in 2023. So even with that strong recovery in 2021 and growth still in 2022, we will still not be where we were in 2019. But there's also the thing that South Africa's growth has been weaker than most peer countries. Part of that is that when we were hit by the COVID pandemic, the economy was already in recession. So what the pandemic did was to make what was a bad situation actually worse. And you could see that apart from Mexico and Peru, the other countries had contracted much less than what we had seen the contraction in South Africa. And this has happened despite a lot of stimulus. The panel on the left shows the amount of stimulus that countries had actually provided. We are from on this slide, the red line, and you could see that compared to the universe, there are only five other countries that have provided a stimulus that is bigger than what we have provided from a fiscal side. On the monetary policy side, a similar picture, but in the case of the monetary side, we had acted with scale and we also acted with speed, and the amount of monetary policy stimulus that was provided is actually the second highest in the world in terms of peer comparison. But our recovery is expected to be relatively slow. So we have had this big shock. Many of the countries are coming out of the shock, according to the projection, faster than we are. So even with that big rebound in 2021, where we grow by just over 4% compared to the rest of the world, it is that we are underperforming peer countries. In as far as the year 2020 is concerned, we have had a very strange situation, because in July, as the economy was reopening, we had then begun to experience load shedding. It was not like July was booming. The economy was just reopening, but we experienced load shedding. And what this panel actually shows you is that 2020 is the worst ever load shedding year, despite the fact that we have had a weak economy. And the bars here shows the extent of the load shedding. The green portion of the bars shows stage two load shedding, and the blue bars show stage one load shedding. And you can see that it has been a terrible year in as far as electricity provision in 2020 was concerned. With those constraints, what you have then seen is that investment has been falling, and with investment falling, that affects our long-run growth capacity, which means that even as you stimulate the economy, the ability of the economy to respond to that rise in demand is constrained because investment has fallen so much, and even when you're trying to get investment going, we are still faced with this electricity constraints, as we had witnessed with load shedding starting again in July. The interesting thing, though, is that we have had on the inflation aside, fairly good performance, although food price inflation is a bit higher than last year, it is still way below the long-term averages. And that has helped to contain the overall inflation picture. And meteorologists are telling us that we might actually be having very good rain this year. And if we have good rain, that could contribute to continuing to have food price inflation actually contained. I went back instead of going forward. So inflation, overall inflation will be contained, as food inflation was contained for this period and was actually lower than the its long-term average. And so inflation has been controlled, and that that helps because inflation had remained within our inflation targeting range of 3 to 6. And it is exactly this performance on the inflation side that provided us with the policy room to provide the monetary stimulus that we had seen. But if you analyze the inflation picture, I need to state here that the oil price collapse is an important part of this equation. And as you would have seen here in the during the lockdown, we had a significant decline in the oil price. Countries were in the lockdown, even here at home, because of the lockdown, people were not driving. And so as a result of that, we had this collapse in the oil price. And that fed itself into the domestic fuel price, as you saw that. We have seen that picking up a bit, but it is still nowhere close to the high point that we had experienced previously. Now, yesterday's inflation and inflation as we see it today is important. It shapes how people think about what inflation is going to be in the future. And policy focuses on what inflation is going to be in the future. What we are actually seeing through the survey of inflation expectation is that South Africans are now getting used to lower inflation. And that augurs well for the performance of the economy going forward. Because if people expect that inflation is going to continue to remain within the target, that provides the space for continued support from a monetary policy side for the economy. And this slide here, that is that food price inflation that I had talked about. The thing that is worrying for South Africa is that the prices that are administered in the main within the control of government, whether central or municipal, have been rising faster than the inflation. The average latest for electricity this year is 6.7%, for water is 10.1%, and for rent and taxes, 4.6%. And by contrast, headline inflation is expected to average 3.1% this year. And so the other way of looking at it is that for the period since 2010, you have had water tariffs rise by 223% to date. And that is a big concern for us. It then says that inflation is contained elsewhere in the economy, but the prices that are actually controlled by different arms of government have been rising faster than what we had actually seen on the inflation front. You could say the same with the electricity. You can see it also risen significantly during this this period. Same goes for municipal rates and taxes, and all of them, as you can see, they have risen faster than the rate of inflation, which is that green line at the bottom of the chart there. The next slide just tries to show what has been contributing to the performance of inflation. Inflation is back in the target range for now, but just barely. In May and June, inflation was below the lower end of the inflation target band. And I think that it's important to also note that that period also coincided with SFSA not being able to survey certain elements of the price formation process, and they had to use statistical techniques to impute what they think would have been the price rises of those particular categories of inflation. But be that as it may, inflation remains contained, and it is not our biggest worry at the moment. Inflation being contained, expected to remain within target, provided the space for the central bank to provide monetary policy stimulus. I said that we acted with speed and we acted with scale. And what that meant is that the prime lending rate now is at a 55-year low. That is that that blue line. What has been the effect? What we have seen is that the monetary policy stimulus that has been provided is beginning to show effect in household credit. And what this chart shows to you is what has been happening with mortgage advances granted, and you can see that there has been that big rebound in mortgages. Mortgage is granted. Again, though, we must be careful of how we interpret that figure because of the lockdown in April and in May. People were not quite looking at purchasing houses, or even when they had made offers, because you had the deed office that was closed and transfer couldn't take place. So when you had a reopening of the economy, you saw that rebound, big rebound. Taking place. But what we're seeing is that that rebound is faster than we have seen in the other years before 2020. The low repo has also been helping with government borrowing costs. Debt is higher, but average interest rate is actually lower for the government. What this shows is that we were able to take the government's debt service costs and take them as a percentage of debt. So in spite of government having raised more debt, the amount of interest paid as a percentage of that debt has actually come down. How has it come down? It has come down partly because government has been borrowing in the short end of the gap, because short rates are so low at the moment, and that has enabled government to actually save in debt servicing costs. So that is what we have seen from the economic side. And let me then now turn to the actual annual report and walk you through the highlights of the annual report. This annual report provides readers with the SARS response to the COVID-19 pandemic, which we have seen the economic effect beginning to filter through in the economy. It's also a concise account of the SARS strategy. It also provides performance against the strategy. And importantly, its the impacts of the SARS activities on broader society. It also does focus on material, financial, and non-financial information. Our response to the COVID-19 pandemic, as I have said, it was done with scale and with speed. We lowered the interest rates by 300 basis points in January. And the repo rate, as I have said, now is at its lowest on record. We have made liquidity available to the South African banking system through a range of facilities in addition to our usual weekly repo auctions. We provided regulatory relief to the financial sector to help maintain the flow of credit in the economy. The South African financial sector was providing debt relief and debt restructuring, and that meant that it was putting a strain on their capital adequacy and their liquidity position, and we provided regulatory relief to allow them to dip into their buffer. They would tend to hold a little bit more capital than it is required by law, precisely so that when they are hit by a shock like this one, they are able to utilize what they had provided as a buffer. We also supported the treasury loan guarantee scheme for funding for small and medium-sized enterprises, starting at 100 billion with an option to increase this to 200 billion over time. And importantly was that we saw that there was a dislocation in the South African bond market, that the bond market was not functioning, and we stepped in into the secondary bond market to purchase bonds to improve the functioning of the South African market. It was important for us to do this because the conduct of monetary policy works through a collateral system, and this collateral must be priced, and so we should be aware of what the value of the collateral is. And if you have got a dysfunctioning market, it is difficult then to price the collateral, and hence our stepping into the bond market to make sure that the market continues to function and that collateral could be priced adequately. Indirectly, this also benefited government because government funds itself in the auctions every week. And if you have got a dysfunctioning market, government would not even be aware as to whether the price that they are charged is reflective of market conditions. So we had to make sure that the market is functioning so that government could also fund itself. We have a constitutional mandate. We had to express this mandate operationally. And the mandate is expressed operationally in a strategic plan that is covered in the annual report. We have got five focus areas of that strategy. The first one being to maintain inflation within the target range. The second strategic focus area is to protect and enhance financial stability. And the third one is to promote and enhance the soundness of the institutions that we are responsible for regulating. And fourth one is to enhance the functioning of South Africa's financial markets in support of resilience. And importantly, the fifth one is to ensure cost-effective availability and integrity of South African bank loans and coins. Together with these strategic focus areas, we also have unique internal strategic process objectives and cross-cutting objectives, which then are the building blocks that enable us to deliver on these strategic focus areas as we had spelled out. And in terms of the performance, this slide gives the performance against those strategic focus areas. I have already talked about the performance with respect to inflation, that it has come out within the target and will continue to be within the target over the next 2 years according to our focus, and importantly is that it will be closer to the midpoint of that inflation targeting range, and that gives us flexibility within the inflation target range. With respect to strategic focus area two, which has to do with financial stability, we have seen no systemic risk events that occurred in the financial system during the period that we are reporting. However, the COVID-19 pandemic will have major implications for the economy and the financial system and may develop into a systemic risk event. The SARB has finalized and published our methodology to determine whether a bank is systemically important and communicated this to the designated bank and the public in the financial stability review earlier this year. With respect to strategic focus area three, which has to do with the soundness of South African of sub-regulated financial institutions, there were no failures of systemically important financial institutions during the period under review, although some smaller institutions were placed under specific regulatory action. All regulated financial institutions have been closely monitored in terms of governance and risk management practices. And the Prudential Authority is leveraging technologies to enhance its supervision capabilities. More on this from would be covered in the Prudential Authority report, which we would deal with later. The strategic objectives and the are crucial for the delivery of our mandate. And the fourth focus area, which has to do with the functioning of the South African financial market, the objectives there have been clearly defined. However, work to develop the practical formulation with respect to this SFA was achieved late in the reporting period. A strong foundation has been laid for further progress in the coming year. And last focus area is has to do with notes and coins. The currency producing subsidiary delivered all notes and coin orders effectively, both for the SARB and for the international export market. The quality standards for notes in circulation is being redefined. Let me then, Chair, move to the financial highlights, and we'll round this part of the report. The subgroup net profit after tax is 285 billion rand this financial reporting year. It was lower than the prior year's group's net profit after tax due to a loss in the Corporation for Public Deposits of 2.77 billion rand. And the CPD loss of 2.77 billion rand is mainly due to the expected credit loss allowance of 2.3 billion rand and an impairment on the land bank promissory note of 600 million rand. The SARB group net profit after tax of 2.85 billion includes an impairment loss on African Bank Limited of 2.3 billion rand. This is a valuation loss. African Bank still reported, but this is a valuation loss of what we have initially put as capital in African Bank. And the South African means net profit after tax of 900 million rand or 0.9 billion rand increased by 42.2% compared to the prior year net profit after compared to the prior year net profit after tax of 0.7 billion rand. This is largely attributable to strong Kruger rand sales. The profit and loss breakdown, what you have there at the bottom is the performance of each one of the subsidiaries of the South African Reserve Bank and how we arrived at that 2.8 billion rand in group process. We do have a social investment and support program as the sub. And our corporate and investment continues to focus on education with the monetary policy schools challenge being our flagship program. The MPC schools challenge was piloted with 70 schools in 2012 and has grown sustainably over the past 4 years, reaching over 3,200 learners in over 400 schools annually. The SAP provides batteries and supports academic institutions and schools for the disabled. The bottom part of that chart just shows you what we had just spelled out, the MPC Schools Challenge, which is a partnership with the Department of Basic Education, helps us to communicate and deepen the understanding of the sub-mandate among grade 12 economics and accounting learners. External bursaries, including one scholarship for arts and culture, is funding of bursaries for young people studying at tertiary institutions, and the funding of two arts and culture bursaries. Recipients are from underprivileged communities, and this has reached 78 beneficiaries. We also do support the universities for research and skills development. We run a competitive process amongst the South African universities, and we do this now through partnerships with universities known as CHAIRS, to derive skills in finance, economics, and central banking, as well as support for financial and economic journalism students at UCT, VET, Rose, and the University of Pretoria. And this program reaches 98 beneficiaries. We have the SAP employee volunteer program. The staff participate in activities at schools for the disabled in areas where it has offices. We support, we provide the support to schools in provinces where the staff does not have a presence, and this reaches 12 schools. The staff employee volunteer program, how it, the way in which it works is that it...
carry on.
The staff volunteer time actually on a Saturday, and they put in labor in those schools, and then the Reserve Bank provides further funding to enable the staff to deliver for those schools that are in need. We have included a slide here on preferential procurement, and our performance against BBBEE progressed well from 19 points in financial year 2018-2019 to 22.7 points for the financial year 2019-2020. The 3.7 point increase is mainly attributable to increased use of technology in managing BBBEE accreditation information from the supplier, the widening of the base to include Black-owned, Black women-owned, and emerging middle enterprise suppliers, and is also focusing on awards of commoditized items and small-scale services to EME suppliers. In terms of the staff composition of the SAP, female representation increased steadily from 29% in 2016 2017 to 35% in 2019-2020. Indian male representation has been increasing by a small margin from 10% in 2016-2017 to 14% in financial year 2019-2020, and white female representation decreased from 42% in 2016-2017 to 29% in 2019-2020. And that is what then reflects in the improvement in the performance of the designated groups in the slide that I have just spelled out here. In terms of the composition of senior management, we have had African male representation increasing from 36% in 2015-2016 to 50% in the period under reporting. White male representation decreased from 51% in 2015-2016 to 33% in 2018-2019. African female representation increased from 39% in financial year 2015-2016 to 49% in 2019-2020. And white female representation has decreased from 46% in 2015-2016 to 34% in the period under consideration. In terms of other human resource highlights, just to say that the staff has conducted three employee engagement surveys to gain insight into how it can improve employee experience. There has been a positive year-on-year movement in dimensions assessed in the employment engagement survey. The total staff composition is 76% black and 24% white. Executive management is 100% black, top management is 55% black and 45% white. Senior management is 66% black and 34% white. The South African Reserve Bank has spent 63.6 million on training and development, and this equates to 1,909 employees, or 87% of the staff complement, attending a training intervention in 2019-2020. We do plan for the future. We provide for what we call the coverage ratio of critical roles, and what that means is that we work a pipeline of, if we lose this crucial skill, would be the people who would be able to step in the period 2018-2019. We had a coverage ratio of 91%. That has declined this year to 82%. It's a ratio that we keep our eye on. It doesn't mean that we can't do our work. All that it means is that if we lose particular people, we will have to go outside of the sub because they wouldn't be readily available skill within the sub to provide for that role. We do also provide for what we call regrettable turnover ratio, which is 1.1% this year. It has declined. The way in which this ratio works is that we have identified what we see as talent within the South African Reserve Bank. And if those people leave the bank, we say that that is a regrettable loss. And we have been able to retain the bulk of those, as you could see, with the improvement of the regrettable turnover that we have. And Chair, that concludes the sub annual report. I will take your guidance as to whether you want to deal with the sub reports now, because I see in terms of the agenda, you have divided the agenda item, in which case we can pause and take the questions. And then once we are done, we can then ask Deputy Governor Naidu to do the highlight from the Prudential Authority report, unless you want to take both reports at the same time.
Thank you, Governor. According to our program, we'll receive the two reports following each other. Then we'll have a deliberation in item 5 for both the reports. So either you continue or you call the Deputy Governor to present the report on the Prudential Authority.
Thank you very much, Chair. Deputy Governor Naidu, I have stopped sharing. You can share from your side.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Governor.
If you're struggling with the sharing, I can share from this side and you can guide me and tell me what's like.
Give me one more second. If that doesn't work, then I will ask you to do that. Okay, Chair, why don't you flash the slides? They're only 5 or 6. I'll only be 8 to 10 minutes, Governor. Okay, Governor, you share, continue sharing your slides. They're only 5 or 6 slides. Thanks. Start on slide 40, please, or you can go to slide 41. Chair, members of Parliament, thank you very much for the opportunity to present on the annual report of the Prudential Authority. I'll take both the report and the slides that have been circulated as read. This slide outlines two committees, the Prudential Committee, which is a governance committee that oversees the work of the Prudential Authority. It is chaired by the Governor and consists of the four governors of the Reserve Bank. The Prudential Authority Management Committee consists of myself as the CEO and the four heads of departments, Suzette Fogelsang, Denzel Bostander, Faisal Jina, and Unati Kamlana. Two of those on the left are responsible for frontline supervision, and the two on the right are responsible for risk support and policy support to the Prudential Authority and to the institutions in which we regulate. Chair, our responsibilities are set out on the slide. Our primary mandate is the safety and soundness of individual regulated institutions, and we contribute towards financial stability, which is a key objective of the Central Bank in the Financial Sector Regulation Act. Governor, move to slide 42, please. Chair, this is a summary slide outlining our response to COVID-19. I know there have been some specific questions on that. As a regulator, I think we were in the fortunate position where, because of the soundness of our banking system and financial system, we could provide significant regulatory relief to enable banks to continue to lend to their customers to support the economy. Generally, in a crisis, you get two things happening. You get a significant fall in demand for credit, and you get a significant increase in risk aversion from banks. Those two in combination often deepens the recession, and prolongs the crisis and slows down the recovery. Our policy objective has been to try and mitigate that as much as we possibly can by providing regulatory relief to the financial sector so that they can continue to lend, continue to support their customers. And Chair, while it's dropped to fairly low levels, credit extension is still positive in South Africa, which is actually quite unusual on a global scale. That suggests that notwithstanding both the fall in demand for credit and in some cases increasing risk aversion, we have continued to see lending and support to customers. Chair, the three main things that we did was normally if a bank restructures a loan, it attracts a higher capital requirement. We changed the regulations to enable the banks to restructure loans, to provide payment holidays without attracting higher capital requirements. We reduced or provided criteria in which banks can reduce their capital by up to 3.5 percentage points, which is quite a large share of their capital, to support lending. And we also reduced the liquidity coverage ratio from 100 to 80. Again, further enabling or providing resources to the financial sector to continue to lend. In addition to that, we provided guidance or guidance notes on expected credit loss accounting, on the payment of dividends and bonuses. We strongly advise those not be paid. And we provided several other guidance notes to the sector. Governor, you can move on. Chair, this slide merely outlines the size of the assets and liabilities of the insurance sector. As you can see, that's dominated by the life insurance sector. So for example, on the asset side, in 2019, we had assets of 3.1 trillion rand. That should read 3.1 trillion, sorry, an error there, not billion. Whereas for non-life insurers, 207 billion rand of assets, composite insurers and reinsurers making up the rest. So over 85%, if 90% of those assets are in the life insurance sector, Chair. Chair, we can move on to slide 44. Chair, this is merely a list of the administrative sanctions that we imposed during the financial year, mainly for AML-CFT compliance breaches. The reasons and the amounts are listed there. And Chair, the last slide is the number of applications that we've received and are in the process of considering. I should state that due to COVID-19, there has been a slowdown in the process of considering license applications. It's been very difficult to get the kind of information that we need from entities. Chair, but if I could summarize, 2019-2020 was the second year of operation of the Prudential Authority. It was a good year in the sense that we have embedded the PA. We've built an integrated organization with banking, insurance, and financial market infrastructure supervision. And we continue to strengthen our IT and data capabilities and our human resource capacity. Chair, let me stop there, and we can then take questions later. Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Deputy Governor, for the presentation on the annual reports of the bank and the Prudential Authority. Members, it's our turn now to engage the two reports. Sister Tebu, who will assist me in identifying members who want to make comments and ask questions. For now, I see Dr. George. Can members raise their hands on the platform? Honorable Abraham. Honorable Mrolong.
only three people. Yeah.
Honorable Shivambu. Do you have the same hands from your side, Sister Tebu, as George Abraham Rolong Shivambu?
Yes, that only four.
Okay, for now. Okay. Those who would like to speak and or ask questions, they will indicate in the process. Let me go to Honorable Dr. George.
Thanks, Chairperson, colleagues. Thanks very much, Governor, for your presentation. Very interesting, as usual. You mentioned that our economic recovery will be slower than our peers. Why would that be? And how did you reach that conclusion? And also, then, before the pandemic began, our economy was already underperforming. Has the bank done any research into why that is so? And then also, finally, the bank has been buying significant quantities of government bonds. Why is this happening? I did read in the report, there was comment on that, but what I'm interested to know is why is the market not capable of functioning to actually absorb these bonds? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Dr. George. Honorable Abraham. No,
yes, Chair, thank you so much. Chair, my first question has been taken by Honorable George on why are we slow in coming out of shock compared to other countries in terms of our economic recovery. My question, therefore, Chair, would be on the actual annual report. The governor reports that interest rates were already lowered by 300 basis points since January. My question is whether this has been informed by the COVID-19 pandemic or just the economic decline that was there from the beginning of the year. Secondly, Chair, the governor mentions a range of facilities that they have afforded to the banks in addition to their usual weekly repo auctions. Could he maybe unpack some of those? What are these range of facilities that have been made available? And in terms of financials, we pick up from the report that the governor gave that there's been 2.8 in group profits. Now, how does this figure compare to the previous years? Do we detect growth or do we detect decline? And the second last question for me, Chair, is the appreciation of social investment support. And if the governor can just go to town in terms of explaining to us as a committee how do they ensure a nationwide beneficiation when it comes to this. Was there anything extra that the Reserve Bank did in this regard, that is, in terms of social investment support, informed specifically by the COVID-19 pandemic? And lastly, Chair, on the Prudential Authority report, there's an issue on the bank and they are restrained in terms of giving out loans from the fund, from the COVID fund that was guaranteed by government. has there been any role that the Reserve Bank has had to play so that the banks are able to disperse the COVID-19 funds that were targeted for struggling businesses? Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much to the presenters as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Noxie. Murolong.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also join members in welcoming the presentation by the governor. I only have two questions, Chair. One is that, are we able to get an indication from the Reserve Bank of how much government bonds it currently holds? The second question, Chair, with respect to the same question is, what is the maximum position that the South African Reserve Bank is willing to take on government bonds? Now, the last question, Chair, is, the loan guarantee scheme has courted controversy given the size of the package announced and how much has been actually spent. Does the Reserve Bank have a view on this matter? And why should a stimulus in terms of guarantees exist if it is not utilized effectively? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Murolo. Honorable Shibambo.
No, thank you, Chairperson. The first issue that I want to raise relates to the committee process in terms of the legislation that we have introduced on the nationalization of the South African Reserve Bank. So I would want us to have deliberation on that, Chair, in terms of what effectively becomes the next step, because I have not seen the public call for submissions into the legislation. In Mana, the legislation should be held. So I think that is one issue that we should raise, because we're talking about the Reserve Bank, whose private ownership must be discontinued in terms of the agreement. And then the second issue that I want the Reserve Bank to speak to is in relation to the transformation of the financial services sector. What is the outlook of Black ownership of the banks and of the insurance companies and all the financial institutions that are regulated, overseen, or licensed by the South African Reserve Bank? Is there any progress? Where the deliberations in the previous parliament in terms of the role of the Reserve Bank in transformation of the financial services sector? What has the bank done like towards achieving in ownership and control patterns that are reflective of South Africa's demographics? But I also want a specific response on how is the licensing of Discovery Bank not conglomeration, because the people who control Discovery Bank is the same people who control RMB, which are very huge financial institutions. How is that not conglomeration in the manner that it is? Aren't we further concentrating bank ownership and control in few hands in the manner that it is when we give licenses to the usual suspects of people who have been in control of the financial services system before apartheid, during apartheid, and they're giving much more deeper privilege currently? And then the other issue that we want to get a clear response on is which countries are the largest destinations of South Africa's financial outflows, both legitimate and unlawful, both lawful and unlawful. Where is South Africa's money going to in terms of what it is? I think that will help to also respond to the question of what has been the role of the Reserve Bank in fighting these illicit financial flows, because there have been many commitments made here that the Reserve Bank has got a role in fighting illicit financial flows. What exactly have you done in terms of fighting illicit financial flows in collaboration, of course, with other relevant entities? And I think that a proper understanding of that will be an outline of the destination of most of the monies that are leaving South Africa, both lawfully and unlawfully, through your system in terms of what could happen. I don't know. I think that both the governor and the Minister of Finance over exaggerate the extent of what is said as the stimulus package into the South African economy, because majority of that component is loan guarantees, majority of which was not utilized because the businesses that are most affected is small and medium enterprises which do not have access to the financial services sector in terms of loan guarantees and whatever form of loans that they could have they acquired. Like of course there was a in government an allocation of 200 billion guarantee scheme, but the last time we checked, less than 15 billion of that was utilized. So I think that the over dramatization of the so-called stimulus package, which if we look deeper into it, never had any meaningful impact in South Africa's economy. So those are the first round of questions, Chair. And I'll plead that we also talk as a committee to the legislation which already has been introduced in the committee as to what becomes the process of these continuing private shareholders from the central bank. Thank you very much.
Thanks, members. I think we'll also respond to the issue of the legislation process. As far as I know, it is in the program of the committee. I think the secretariat will indicate that, but somewhere in November, I think there's going to be a platform for public hearings and submissions. But I think that, as I've said, secretariat will have to look at the program before we conclude the meeting and clarify as to where are we. I usually don't like to ask questions, but just to make an input, probably you might want to respond to that. We have never had this kind of economic crisis for the past 90 years or so, since the Great Depression, which lasted almost 5 years from 1925 to 1934. And this lockdown pandemic doesn't seem like something that will just go away in the next year or two, as you have properly projected and the stats from Stats SA. We'll continue to lose jobs. The past 2 days, we have received reports from Treasury and SARS, which also gave us the same figures, that 2.2 million jobs have already been lost from end of March till now. And the economy continued to decline. And coronavirus has battered the economy and the government finances. As I've said, that we have never been in a deepest crisis like this for almost 90 or 80 something years. I don't know whether we think the market forces on their own can be able to revive this economy without a drastic state intervention. And that state intervention also include the Reserve Bank. Whether in the light of this, what has happened, is it not time that the Reserve Bank look at itself as an active agent of economic transformation and job creation, and broaden its mandate. We acknowledge what the bank has done in terms of reducing the repo rates and other measures, but can't it do more? I know governors have in other platforms raised their views in terms of broadening the mandate of the Reserve Bank. Probably that was before coronavirus pandemic. Now the coronavirus pandemic is here with us, it's a fact. Businesses are closing on a daily basis. People are losing jobs. And as you have correctly said, we are one of the countries that have the highest stimulus packages into the economy, but with less impact into the lives of our people. Is it not time that the mandate of the bank should be beyond only inflation targeting? That is to defend the rand and look at a broader mandate. Which other banks, central banks in the world, have actually ventured into? It's a matter for debate, but it's a reality. Unless you have members of your family and relatives and people in your community whom you have seen losing jobs, their houses and their properties being repossessed by the banks, you will not understand the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. So it's a matter that has to be looked at. We can't run away from it, and when we debate it, we just become dismissive. We have to be factual in advancing our debate. But let me welcome the reports of the governor and the deputy governor, as other members have done. Over to you, governor and the deputy governor.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will take 13 questions and pass the others to my colleagues. Deputy Governor Naidu, if you could deal with all the questions that have to do with the loan guarantee schemes, the licensing, the transformation of the financial sector, the illicit financial flows. Those seems to have your name written all over there. And those questions that come from Honorable Abrams and from Honorable Shivambo and Honorable Morolong. And then DG Chasivana, I would like you to deal with the bond buying program and why we had to do that. And then also the maximum that can be bought and how much bonds we are holding. And then I will take the other questions, and whichever ones are difficult, I will hand over to DG Kasim. Honorable George asked the question about why our recovery is slower than peers. Getting into the COVID-19, or let me put it this way, COVID-19 simply made what was a bad situation worse. This economy had its own structural challenges even before COVID-19. These problems were captured in the government's diagnostic report, which was a precursor of the National Development Plan. So the things that we were supposed to do in terms of the National Development Plan were not done, and because they were not done, the economy's potential growth rate, which is the maximum rate at which the economy can grow, has been declining over a period of time. And so what that meant was that if there is a sudden economic shock, the economy gets not just thrown off course, but the impact of the shock becomes so much deeper. And why would we be underperforming other countries' peers in the recovery? It is because we have not dealt with those structural constraints. I was highlighting earlier on that in July we were hardly growing. The economy was just opening up, and yet we started to have load shedding. So electricity is now a binding constraint on investment. The stuff that has to be done to change the structure of this economy are known. They are within the control of the publicly elected officials, and they know what it is that ought to be done to change the structure of the economy. You can't change the structure of the economy through monetary policy action. You change that through structural policies, and that is what needed to be done. Because we have left those things undone, the other countries, when they are now looking at the recovery, they are building on the structural strength that they had built. But because we have not dealt with our structural constraints, we are unable to move out of the shock as quickly as our peers. Honorable Abraham raises the question of was the monetary policy adjustment informed by COVID? Mainly, yes, but we had already started relaxing monetary policy in January. Why did we start relaxing monetary policy in January? Because our outlook for inflation in January said to us that inflation is going to be contained, that it would be closer to the 4.5%, which is the midpoint of the inflation targeting range. And because of that, it provided the scope for us to commence the process of monetary policy relaxation or stimulus. We were only able to do that because the inflation outlook had improved, and inflation was expected to remain contained. It is that enabled us to start that. When the COVID-19 then hit our shores and became more pronounced, we decided to accelerate the process of providing monetary policy relief in March. And when the lockdown was extended further after the initial lockdown, we deemed it fit to call an extraordinary meeting the Tuesday immediately after Easter so that we could provide further relief rather than wait until the main meeting of the Monetary Policy Committee. So we had started relaxing policy before COVID, but the advent of COVID meant that we have got to relax policy both in terms of scale and in terms of the speed at which we had to do it. There is also the issue about the facilities that were being provided for the banks. What were they? How were they done? And what were they for? It was a question from Honorable Abrams, which is an important point to raise. So you can deal with that because it was also part of the bond purchasing. The profit performance, that we have stated that the profit performance was indeed a decline in profits from the previous year. But as we said, the bank remained profitable, and I am trying to go to the relevant slide. It is actually captured in a slide entitled Financial Highlights, and the profit has come down. The previous year it was 5.8 billion rand, and it has come down this year to be 2.8 billion rand. Now, some of the things that drive the SAP's profit performance has to do with international bond yields and what actually also happened to the exchange rate. But this year, the loss was also, the reduction in the profit rather, was driven in the main by the provision for the loss on the holding of land bank paper, and secondly, a valuation adjustment of the shareholding in African Bank Limited. Social investment and support nationwide. And let me say that the most extensive social investment for the Reserve Bank in terms of reach is the Monetary Policy Committee. And this now, as we have said, it has now reached over 3,200 learners, and it has reached over 400 schools. And that is now countrywide. We have our people on the ground working with the educators, working with the Department of Basic Education in the various provinces to extend the reach of this program. It is a nationwide program. The other component which has to do with the support of the schools of the disabled, it is a niche that we decided to pick. Why did we pick this niche? One of the things that we had was that we were not doing as well as we should be doing in terms of attracting people with disabilities. And so we decided that is the sector that we should support, and through that process we would be able to identify people that we can bring in into the bank who have got disabilities. We have got about two or three that had come through that program in the bank. Did we change our social investment program in the event of COVID? No, we didn't change our social investment program, but we did do something else. In line with the call of the president, myself and the deputy governor gave up a third of our net remuneration, for a period of 3 months. And the staff of the Reserve Bank also decided that they would want to give away 25% of the bonus pool of the Reserve Bank to the Solidarity Fund. And in addition to that, there are staff members of the bank who said that they have got leave. They decided that they would encash that leave and give that fund, that money that is due to them to the Solidarity Fund. So those are the changes that we made in terms of our social investment program. Yes. So Shall we start with you, DG Chatibana, and then we will go to DG Naidu, and then I will then deal with the questions that have to do with the mandate and growth.
Thank you, Governor. So let me start by responding to the questions asked by Honourable George and Honourable Murillo about the purchase of government bonds. So we started purchasing government bonds at the end of March, and the primary objective of this was to ensure that markets continue to function. So Honourable George asked, why were the markets not functioning? And what we saw towards the end of March was that there was a lot of selling of government bonds and not enough buyers of these bonds. And this was driven by a combination of what was happening outside of South Africa in terms of financial markets in general. There was a lot of risk aversion among investors as the level of COVID-19 infection started to spread and increase globally. And there was a lot of sell-off. And generally what happens when there's panic in financial markets, there's a shift to what are called safe haven assets, which would be buying stocks in the US and in countries like Japan. So there was that element, and it not only affected South Africa, but emerging market countries in general. There was also a South Africa specific event in that there was expectation that we would be downgraded by the last of the credit rating agencies that had an investment grade level. And some investors, in terms of how they manage their portfolios, started to sell their holdings of government bonds in anticipation of what would happen with this downgrading of South Africa's sovereign bonds. And the combination of the two factors therefore resulted in an oversupply of government bonds. Now, the South African government bond market is a very important part of our capital market in the country. Yes, we have a corporate bond market, but it's not as large as the government bond market. And government is the largest single borrower in the economy. So the staff then took steps to normalize conditions in the government bond market. And what we were doing as a staff was not to take over the role of the market, but to try and simulate what would be natural market conditions. And you would realize that we have been buying government bonds in the secondary market and not in the primary market, because the focus was on ensuring that the market would function rather than monetizing the deficit that government has had. So when one looks at just the government bond market, given the size of government issuance and the level of national savings that we have, one does need to have healthy participation of both domestic investors plus foreign investors as well. So our purchases of government bonds were largely during the months of April and May, when we saw a lot of sell-off and very limited demand. So we bought government bonds for about 14 billion rand in April, 10 billion rand during the month of May. But as market conditions have normalized and we have started to see more healthy or more normal levels of supply and demand in the government bond market, we have slowed down our purchases of bonds. So the Honourable Morlo wanted to know, what is the size of our holdings? It's around $39 billion. Oh, sorry, 39 billion rand at the moment. Excuse the pun. It's not that large. So 39 billion rand are the current holdings of government bonds. And in terms of the maximum amount, there is no maximum limit that is prescribed within the SARB Act on how much the SARB will purchase in the secondary bond market. There is a limit that is prescribed in terms of our purchases in the primary market. Unfortunately, though, we cannot announce in a public platform what the size of our purchases could be, because this is market sensitive information. So regarding the facilities that that we provided for banks, Honorable Abrams, so what we found also from around the middle of March was that banks did not have sufficient access to the funds that they would normally utilize to continue with their normal lending activities. And this was largely because some of the large depositors to the banks were wanting to hold on to the deposits that they had in banks in order to be able to call on these funds. So if you were a large business at the start of the COVID-19 crisis and you were worried about your future revenue stream, what you would do is you would say to the bank, look, I might need this money because I still have a fixed set of costs, but if things, if conditions continue to deteriorate with COVID, this amount of mine is not, should always be available. So banks were in that position from around the middle of March. The SARB therefore provided additional windows for the banks to come to the SARB to borrow cash. So normally banks come to the SARB once a week on a Wednesday, and they get some funding from the SARB in order to meet the cash requirements fully. What we did during this period was we provided additional facilities. So we started off by providing a daily facility. So banks could come to the Reserve Bank twice a day, in the morning and the afternoon, to come and get some cash. We retained the weekly repo lending facility, which is on a Wednesday. We also added a lending facility, which was over a longer period, what we call term lending. And we're still quite open for this to be available to banks up to a period of 12 months. But so far the demand has been for term lending of about 3 months. Thank you, Chair. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Chair, just to add to Deputy Governor Chazibana, I think year to date foreigners have been net sellers of about 69 billion of South African government bonds. TZ Chazibana, I'm sure, would know the right number. Thank you very much for the questions, Chair and Committee. Let me start off on the loan guarantee scheme. The loan guarantee scheme is a public-private partnership, a partnership between the Treasury and the private banks, negotiated between the Treasury and the private banks, with the Reserve Bank playing a role of administrator of the scheme. We take no direct risk in the scheme, but we do help to administer the scheme. Chair, the nature of the agreement is that it's a risk-sharing arrangement, with the banks taking a certain share of first loss and the Treasury taking a share afterwards. I think you are correct. We would love the take-up to have been much higher. However, I do think that there's some very good reasons why the take-up has not been higher, and I think it's important to bear those reasons in mind. The first reason is that this scheme is designed so that if you're a customer in good standing, at the end of December, and you approach your bank, you've been impacted by COVID, and if you're a very good customer, the bank is likely to give you the loan or the credit on their own balance sheet. If you're a very bad customer, they're probably not likely to give you a loan, and the banks would have their own risk appetite for that. If you're somewhere in the middle, I think that there's a role for the loan guarantee scheme in a form of a partially guaranteed amount. By the time that the loan guarantee scheme actually kicked in, which I think was on the 12th of May, the commercial banks had already done a significant amount of debt restructuring and provided payment holidays to a significant portion of its customers. About 24% of individual customers had received some form of debt holiday or repayment holiday or debt restructuring, a slightly lower proportion of corporates, but a significant amount of money. So Chair, there have been three buckets of support that the banks have been able to provide. The first is payment holidays. The second is loan restructures. And the third is through the loan guarantee scheme. If you take all of those three in total, that's relief of direct amounts of about 50 billion rand on gross loans and advances of about 700 billion rand, Chair. That's quite significant. That's a fairly significant share of the total loans and advances in the economy. So I think the timing of the loan guarantee scheme, the nature of the risk sharing are two reasons. Chair, in addition, unfortunately, there is a fall in demand for credit when there is economic uncertainty. If a small business has been impacted by COVID and they have a choice between closing down or retrenching staff or to stop operations and taking on additional debt, if they have a high level of confidence in the future, a high level of confidence that things will turn around and incomes would grow in the near future, they're likely to take debt. But if they are uncertain of the economic prospects going forward, they are not likely to take on additional debt. And I think that it's important for policymakers to understand that the demand for credit falls in part because of the uncertainty around economic prospects going forward, Chair. So the SARB's view on the loan guarantee scheme is that it has played a positive role in supporting lending to the economy. It has not reached as many people as we would have liked to have reached, but I think I've explained some of the context for that. In general, when you have a crisis, you have a fall in both demand for credit and a fall in risk appetite for the banks. Some of that is natural, and we have seen a fall in demand for credit, and of course you've seen some risk aversion on the banking sector side. But in general, the South African banking sector has kept credit flowing, has supported their customers during this crisis. Would it have been great for them to have done more? Yes. But at the end of the day, the banks also have to worry about safety and soundness and have to worry about their own security in a sense. I think that in general, in previous crises, the financial sector have been amplifiers of the crisis. In this crisis, the financial sector has been a mitigant of the crisis. It has reduced the amplitude of the crisis, and that's positive. And Chair, it has only been possible because our banking sector is safe and sound, well regulated, has adequate capital and liquidity buffers, that it has been able to play a positive role. Should it play a more positive role? Certainly. But I think the context and understanding that in previous crises the banking sector contributed to the crisis, whereas in this crisis they have not, I think is an important one to be borne in mind, Chair. Chair, the second cluster of issues I want to deal with is the transformation issues, the transformation of the financial sector. The Financial Sector Regulation Act gives the Prudential Authority a primary mandate of safety and soundness, but gives us four important secondary mandates. So in addition to the primary mandate, we have a legal obligation to take into account transformation, competition, financial inclusion, and the integrity of the financial system. Chair, we do that. Our program on transformation of the financial sector is informed by the Financial Sector Charter, so we don't have our own scorecard. When we have prudential meetings with the banks, we discuss all four of those secondary objectives as well. We discuss their progress on meeting the requirements of the Financial Sector Charter, their requirements on financial inclusion. Of course, individual banks won't give you a view on competition. Integrity is largely dealt with through the anti-money laundering process, which we supervise the banks. Chair, transformation is a multidimensional objective. Black ownership is an objective. Black boards, CEOs, executives, the human resource development factor is an objective. Ensuring that there are adequate numbers of black participants in the supply chains in the financial sector is an important consideration. But equally important is the ability to lend to small businesses, to the township economy, to black businesses in particular. South African banks have historically not done significantly well in lending to the small business sector, and this is a 100-year-old problem, not a 20-year-old problem. And I think that there's certainly room for progress and improvement in the ability of the financial sector to support small business. But Chair, in general, the financial sector is making progress on all of those dimensions of ownership, procurement, human resource management, and the diversity of the people that it lends to. Again, we use the financial sector charter and each bank's performance on the financial sector charter as a metric when we discuss with them. This is a responsibility we share jointly with the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. Chair, the last category of issues I want to deal with is the financial outflows and our role in fighting illicit financial flows. Chair, the answer to the first part of the question is fairly easy. There are three types of financial outflows that are legitimate and legal. The largest of those is interest or dividend payments, interest on government bonds or other bonds, and dividend payments from investments on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. We know exactly who that goes to by name and by location. The second largest outflow is for purchasing imports, of which the largest category would be oil. But there's a very detailed account of who we import from, and the money flows out to pay for those imports. Thirdly, Chair, we pay for services. A lot of those services are IT services. So when I pay my Microsoft license fee, that's a service fee that goes out. But Chair, tourism plays a significant role when South Africans go abroad and spend money. That's a service payment. When foreigners come in and spend money, that's an income. Chair, the national accounts data has got a detailed account of where that money goes to by country. Of course, what we don't know is where the illicit outflows go to. We have a sense, we have a flavor, we have suspicions. But Chair, let me make 2 points in this regard. On the instruction of this committee, government set up an interdepartmental committee consisting of the police, the Hawks, SARS, the Reserve Bank, the FIC, and the National Treasury to combat illicit financial flows. Chair, there's been steady progress in the work of that committee. There's been improving cooperation between agencies and entities in government to curb financial flows. Our cooperation with SARS, with the Financial Intelligence Center, has grown in leaps and bounds in the last year or two, and we're making steady progress. Chair, as an example of the steady progress that we're making, 5 years ago when I came into this job, we were freezing about 20 accounts a year to a value of about 30 to 50 million rand. Chair, now we, between account freezing accounts and forfeitures, we're doing about 200 to 250 a year, totaling at least 300 to 400 million rand. There is one forfeiture that's run into billions, but there's been a dramatic improvement in our enforcement capability. All of this is in the Government Gazette. Every time I sign a forfeiture order, it's published in the Government Gazette. There's no secrecy about this. There's full transparency. Every single account blocked has to go through a Government Gazette process, Chair. So we feel that we're making slow but steady progress in combating illicit financial flows, but Chair, even more cooperation is required between the various agencies and entities. Chair, I think I've dealt with the three main categories of questions. I'm happy to take a break now and come back later if there are additional questions.
DG Kasim.
Thank you very much, Governor. Yeah, let me just put on my camera. The Chair asks a really important question, and that is that, you know, what role should the SARB play in stimulating the economy? It's quite important to kind of distinguish two things. At the beginning of the pandemic, an important function that we really played was almost through monetary policy providing cash relief. In other words, when you reduce the interest rate, you make two assumptions. The one assumption you make is that those who have loans will experience more cash flow as the interest rate of their mortgage or other loans go down. They will use that money and stimulate aggregate demand. That is why when often we say 100 basis points reduction in the interest rate based on a model will more or less give you a 0.3 or 0.4% increase in GDP. That was a really important part of the first part of the pandemic stimulus. And it really revolves around the fact that you provided stimulus primarily in the month of March and April. In those months, there was a lockdown, spending was constrained except in necessities and so on. I think what will happen subsequently as the economy has opened up, the effect of the stimulus through monetary policy will be seen as we go along. The effect of the 300 basis points, we often say that the full effect takes about 18 months to 24 months. That's based on empirical research and so on. So that is one important part to it. The other important part to it is that, one can get, I know the governor may explicitly deal with the mandate argument, but just at a more technical level, there are a number of ways one feels the pulse of the economy to get a sense of what the monetary policy stance should be. So for example, in the US, the US has an employment mandate. No country has an employment target because monetary policy is too crude an instrument to deal with employment. In our case, we have something more technical, which is essentially similar to an employment mandate, and we call it an output gap. What the output gap means is that the economy is performing below its potential, and monetary policy has a role to stimulate the economy. So in a sense, you could say that our inflation targeting is a flexible inflation targeting, and it has scope for stimulating the economy when the output gap is negative, given the fact that we have, given our inflation mandate and so on. I also want to emphasize that countries that have introduced quantitative easing have done so because they basically have not had their interest rate tool to stimulate the economy. So in an ideal world, if a country's interest rate was pre a recession or pre a pandemic was 0.5 basis points, they would have to go to like a negative interest rate. But one of the ways that they practically do this is they introduce their balance sheet, they buy more bonds and so on to stimulate the economy. So they use the asset channel to stimulate the economy. In our case, we have a very powerful tool. The interest rate, notwithstanding the other complementary tools in banking regulation and markets. So I believe that the Saab will continue to stimulate the economy. We are in stimulation mode. If inflation becomes even more benign, further away from the midpoint of the target, there will still be scope to stimulate the economy. And I think this is quite an important, and one must not lose sight of the fact that the most effective strategy, a tool to stimulate the economy, the tool that the Saab has at its behest is the monetary policy tool. And countries that don't have monetary policy tools really have to work very hard using very cumbersome balance sheet policies to be able to stimulate the economy. Thank you.
Thanks, DG. I mean, I think you have dealt with that quite well. According to my list, Chair, I think we have exhausted the questions.
Chair, there was one question on Discovery Bank licensing that I did not respond to. Chair, let me respond in the following way: that I don't want to answer in public in relation to an individual bank or institution. I do, however, want to make the point that in some ways there is a trade-off between promoting competition in the financial sector and entrenching incumbency. Our view was that the licensing of Discovery Bank would promote competition in the financial sector. Here you have a financial institution with significant heft, significant capability. We think that they can compete with the Big Four or the Big Six, and that would contribute positively towards competition in the financial sector. Chair, we should also note that since the publication of draft standards on conglomerate supervision, there have been at least two changes in the financial structure in the South African economy, with two significant conglomerates announcing unbundling transactions. I think there's a direct relationship between the publication of draft regulatory standards on conglomerates and those two financial transactions that have, I think, have contributed towards those two transactions. Chair, if there is an issue around competition, I think that that issue should best be dealt with through the competition authorities, Chair.
Okay. Let's take a follow-up question. Honorable Shwambu, Honorable Abram.
Okay, instead of just brushing aside the question of transformation, can we be given a detailed report on all the financial institutions' compliance to what the central bank says it's a gauge of transformation, the charter on the financial services sector? Who complies, who doesn't comply in terms of ownership and all other aspects that gauge transformation correctly? So that we can know what to do, because it looks like the whole compliance to transformation dictates it's just voluntary and there's no consequences when the financial services sector does not comply. Can we be given a detailed breakdown of to what extent have these financial institutions, probably the banks and the insurance companies, how to what extent have they complied to the financial services charter, so that we know who is in the wrong? And also the question of outflows. Can we be given the list and amounts of money which goes to different destinations in terms of countries, just which countries are recipient of South African money? Because in one of the lists that was presented possibly 3-4 years ago, Mozambique as one of the biggest destinations, or the number one recipients of South African money, whilst when you gauge that against real economic activity, there isn't much, but those destinations, including some tax havens, become destination of South African money. It then gives direction in terms of where do we look at when we want to deal with the broader phenomena of tax avoidance and profit shifting, which defines a lot of multinational corporations. So that must not be, it must not be, by the way, issue that like we are dealing with it. It's a multi-agency thing. The Reserve Bank is better placed to could respond to that much more meaningfully. I think it should matter to the Reserve Bank as to who controls RMB and Discovery Bank. Because if you were to go deeper into it, RMI is the same board that ultimately controls Discovery Bank. Why even if it's competition of what? Of siblings, of a conglomeration that is from the same basket. When we've got a crisis of other entrants into the financial services sector, you as the bank, you deliberately approve a license of FNB or of RMB now acting like it's Discovery Bank and everything else. It should matter to the bank, the licensing institution, in terms of just who are the role players in the financial services sector, because your licensing seems to be reproducing the ownership inequalities, the demographic inequalities that define ownership of banks in terms of what should happen. Maybe at that as well, we might need to be given a clearer update in terms of the African bank exit. When is the Sovereign Reserve Bank exiting the African bank? Because you can't be a regulator and owner of a bank in the manner that it is. So that should happen. And other banks as well must exit African bank, because it certainly violates competition laws in the manner that it is structured now. And of course, there was an understandable temporary intervention that had to be made to African Bank. But when is the exit going to be effected from the African Bank? Thank you.
Thanks. Honorable Abram.
No, Chair, I am sufficiently answered. I might have forgotten to lower my hand on the device. Thank you.
Okay. Sister Tebuch, are there other members on your side who want to make comment and or ask questions?
It was only the two, Honorable Abram and Shivam.
Okay. Over to you, Governor, on the follow-up questions from Honorable Shivam.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll ask Deputy Governor Naidoo to add something here. We might be better placed in doing things, but I can tell you that if there is tax shifting and all of that, that is SARS. It's not us. We do not have taxpayer information. We do not keep taxpayer information. SARS that keeps the taxpayer information. I think Deputy Governor spelled out illicit and legitimate outflows. I think we could have gone further and said within the legitimate outflows, besides the dividends and the interest that must be paid, there is also the issue of whether the money flows out through the bond market because the people who are holding the bonds have sold them, or whether people who were holding the shareholding have sold the shareholding. And that is in a market, in the South African bond market, with a turnover of some 18 trillion rand. So the money is constantly moving. And because it is constantly moving, you will find it being held via a repository offshore, and it goes through that repository. But Naidoo will add to that. If the monies are illicit, by definition, that means that it has gone out illegally, you do not see it. So you can't be able to tell exactly where it has gone. But since, Kubeni, you are in that multi-agency group, I suppose you would help. Chair, you must help us here. There is the issue of detailed reports per individual institutions and how they have complied with their objectives. I need to state here, by law, we cannot disclose regulatory information. The easiest thing for this committee to do would be to call the individual institutions and ask each institution, how have you done in terms of this measure? It used to be the practice of this committee every year to receive the report of the financial sector charter. That report was being published annually, and this committee used to engage with it. What became of that, I do not know. But it was an accountability mechanism. The financial sector, through the financial sector charter council, used to come to this committee to present that annual report. Even that annual report that was being presented, it was not being broken down per institution. It was saying, this is the state of the sector. And you have got to help us here. We cannot get into the individual institution. Ditto for RMI and Discovery stuff. We cannot comment with respect to that. There was particular regulatory action that was taken to make sure that there is fair competition, which depending on where it is, maybe it could be stated, but I would caution against asking us to comment on the individual institutions, because it is within the power of this committee to call the individual institutions and ask them those specific questions. Because if we are to go and start commenting on the individual institutions, we would be violating our regulatory prescripts and possibly the privacy provisions in terms of the act of this of this country. African Bank, yes, we would like to exit. It's not something that we wanted to hold on to. And elsewhere in the world, when there is a crisis like what happened with African Bank, is the treasuries that are taking that stake, not the central bank, precisely to address the concerns of Honorable Shivambu. Because then the treasury is not the regulator. It will just be the shareholding. At the time when it happened, our treasury was not prepared to come in with the money. The banks were prepared to come with the money because they were worried about the system. And that is how we ended up with the situation like the one that we have had. They had always understood that they would have to exit. It is not profitable for them to do these things because an investment by one bank in another is categorized as an impairment of capital. They would like to deploy this capital elsewhere. That as it might be, let me say to the committee that we have appointed a transaction advisor for us to exit our stake in African Bank. And we must also be cognizant that there are provisions in the resolution agreement that said when we exit, we shall exit as the same proportion as the bank. So we have got a 50% stake holding. If we sell 50% of our stake, the banks will also sell 50% of their stakes individually. And that is where we are. The process is in motion. But given where we are now, there are the issues of timing with respect to markets. We cannot put the taxpayers' money at risk by exiting just because we are running for the door, which is why we have a transaction advisor who would take this process forward. DG Naidoo?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I think you've covered most of it. Just to make 2 points, the one is that the Financial Sector Charter Council does publish a report on the status of transformation. Again, I think if the committee wants individual bank or insurance company data, I think that they're better placed to get it directly. When the Reserve Bank publishes its quarterly bulletin, it does publish a statement on by country on South African holdings of savings abroad and vice versa. It doesn't quite give you a flavor of the flows, but you can see exactly where South African assets are held and who holds South African assets here, Chair. The one category of financial flows that I did not mention was remittances. They're significant. They're mainly to our neighboring states, but they also go as far afield as sort of India, Pakistan, China, Somalia, etc. When they're done electronically or through regulated authorized dealers or ADLAS authorized dealers with limited authority, we do have a track of those funds as well, Chair, and we track them. Thank you.
That is it from our side in terms of the question, the follow-up questions that we were able to check.
Okay. It looks like we are done with the questions and the comments. We are coming to the end of the meeting. In regard to the financial services transformation report, members will remember that we had a meeting last year. I can't remember the date. I think Secretariat will have to remind us. If you remember, we're at the old Assembly Chamber. And we had many stakeholders attending that meeting. We agreed that we should have a follow-up session because NEDLAC, which was supposed to provide leadership in that regard, was not well prepared for that meeting on that day. So I think the Secretariat, look at the minutes of that summit that we had at the old Assembly Chamber on that day last year. And then where we make a follow-up on the decisions that were taken in regard to the financial services transformation. And then so that we can report to members as to what is the next action, so that we have the next, we plan for the next summit. And then they will have to provide detailed information in regard to what the members are looking for when it comes to financial services transformation. On the amendment bill, reserve amendment bill process, public participation will be next month on the 11th of November. So there will be public hearings, oral and written submissions. There is an outstanding report, Alan and Sister Tebogo. I think it is that team which is led by Advocate Kanyile. Is it the same team that's dealing with the illicit financial flow, or they're dealing with something else?
No, it's the same team. It's the same team.
Yeah, if I remember, that team should have come to report to the committee in April this year. And we were disturbed by the lockdown and the outbreak of the pandemic. So make a follow-up with Advocate Kanyile and a team that we have to get that report that is still outstanding. When we meet Treasurer with the economic, to present the economic recovery plan, there are certain things that ourselves as policymakers will have to take up with Treasurer. We can't expect governors here to make policy. They are cautious because it was us last year when we visited the Reserve Bank in Pretoria during the induction week, who emphasized that we didn't want governors to make their individual opinion in regard to policy aspect outside what is there, and they enter the political space. So it becomes our responsibility to engage Treasurer when they come with the economic recovery plan, like an issue raised by Deputy Governor Kasim on the output gap as to what does it mean, actually, the concept. Because he talks about monetary policy being used to stimulate the economy. So we'll want to engage in detail in regard to that concept. So how will it go in a long way to stimulate the economy? Because the economy is declining. And if we'll go the 1929-1934 Great Depression, it means we'll have another 5 years or so of economic stagnation. But I see the bank is projecting some growth at some stage. We don't know. We'll have to reconcile all these projections and see how that in itself will translate into creating jobs. And the economy should not just grow. It should also grow in a manner that even the structure has to change. Those who have been marginalized by this economy should come into the economic mainstream. But if we talk about recovering the economy for those who are controlling the economy, that will be problematic. We must talk about an inclusive growth. If it is not an inclusive growth, it will not mean much to the people of this country who are in the majority. So we'll discuss that when we meet with Treasury to discuss the economic recovery plan. Thanks very much, honorable members, governor, deputy governors, officials from the bank and its entity, Prudential Authority, and officials from Parliament. Thanks very much until we meet again. You can see in Inko Mubaya Danke Noxte.
Long live the chair.
Next call, the Inko,
thank you very much.
Governor, you want to fight Bako Marivani now, or when?
I want to fight Rishimisha Mobile.
Ah, pull the house in the top, why don't they export the cable?
I don't know.
Oh, well, just a few meters from town.
thank you, Chair.
No, thanks, Governor, your team. Sure.
Thank you, Mamuchas Bana.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bokotos, I'm a cousin.
Yeah.